This Edgar Profiles podcast is supported by Ping. Edgar is an association of national federations formed in the year 2000 to develop and encourage initiatives which raise the awareness of golf, both as a participation and competitive sport for individuals with disability. For more information about Edgar, please visit edgargolf.com. Your host for this episode is Tony Bennett. Ping. Play your best.
I'm Tony Bennett. Before I start, I would like to tell you a short, personal, and true story about Ping.
A key resource that has enabled Ping to perform experiments and extensive tests on new golf designs is a superhero who was once described as the world's best golfer. At only 5 feet high, 6 feet wide, and 7 foot thick, weighs over 1,000 pounds, he is known as Pingman. Pingman is a robot that is used for product and prototype testing. He mimics human movement by having a shoulder turn and a wrist hinge that can load a golf shaft on the way down. He can even bend 10 degrees at the waist like a human golfer to accommodate clubs from a wedge to a driver. Pingman hits tens of thousands of golf balls a year. He only hits brand new golf balls to ensure accurate testing and tests 9 different face locations on the product to ensure we know exactly how product will perform from not only centrally struck shots, but from off-center struck shots too. Pingman can swing it up to 160 miles per hour, which compared to a couple of Ping's big hitters in Bubba Watson and Tony Finau, who get it out at a very respectable 125 miles per hour, Pingman is like no other golfer on the planet. Thanks to the data Pingman produces, Ping only introduces new product when testing it to be proven to be better performing than the current product.
For most golfers, the air at St Andrews is different. The wind, that often blows off the West Sands, carries with it the souls of some of the greatest players and club makers ever to grace the game. Alan Robertson, Jamie Anderson, Robert Forgan, and of course, the legendary duo, Old Tom and Young Tom Morris. To visit the home of golf is special. To set foot on one of the famous links for many is a career highlight. But to walk the hallowed turf of the old course as a player and a caddy more than 5,000 times, well, that is the stuff of dreams. My guest today has worked at the links in St Andrews for 30 years. Paul Ellison is an accomplished golfer, but his life's work has been to help players enjoy their experience of the links, first as a caddy with players such as Samuel L. Jackson benefiting from his good advice, and more recently, as his disability of hereditary spastic paraplegia has progressed, as one of the men who make sure that players and caddies are all where they're supposed to be, at golf's most iconic venue. It was a pleasure for me to chat with Paul, and I hope you enjoy this round as much as I did. Yeah, great to catch up with you, Paul, and thanks for making the time to chat. And for almost 30 years, every day you go to work in a place that most golfers would love to go just once in their golfing lifetime. So St Andrews, the home of golf. And how did you first come to work in the old grey tune?
I suppose I was lucky as a child. My grandparents lived in St Andrews. So as a 13-year-old in the summer, I got to go and spend time over there, and I remember one of our neighbours was a caddy and had been for a long, long time. I mean, he was already in he would have been 60 when I met him. So I remember one day I got taken down to the golf course, and the next minute I knew I was on the golf course going as a bag carrier, and that was it. Loved it. I learned what to do, and then I think I spent every summer holiday there until I was, well, that would have been 13, 17, and I decided caddying was going to be my career, and I've done it. Well, I caddied up until 11 years ago.
So you must have done plenty of Open Championships, plenty of Dunhill Championships. What's been the highlight of your caddying there?
I suppose the Dunhills. I really enjoyed the Dunhills. I enjoyed caddied for Samuel L. Jackson. That was great fun. Opens, I did one Open. Opens are very tough to get into just because you've got to go through open qualifying and stuff. So Dunhills, I think, were right. I really enjoyed Dunhills.
And you said you caddied for Samuel L. Jackson?
Yes, I have. I was lucky enough to, I think, maybe 5 Dunhills caddy for him. It was really enjoyable. It was fantastic.
It seems like all the guys are very relaxed when they go to the Dunhill. Certainly the celebrities seem more relaxed and the professionals seem more relaxed as well. Is that how you find it?
Yeah, I think so. I think most of the celebrities there, they're a little bit out of their own environment because they're going into the professional golfers' environment rather than their own, you know, like guys that are actors. But most of them are used to it and they know how to behave. And, you know, I think the frustrating bit, it becomes maybe harder for the professional golfer because they're maybe not quite used to people invading their, you know, they're not used to amateurs invading their space like what they normally would be in a pro tournament.
Right.
And it does take, and it can take a long time as well. I mean, rounds in the Dunhill can be near 6 hours, which, you know, especially on the old course, you've got double greens, double fairways, it can just take a long time.
Well, I'd love to dig into some of that with you, and at some point, I'm sure we'll share a beer and you can tell me all about the peculiarities of the old course. I've been fortunate to play it on several occasions, and every time it's just a delight to play. But what does your average working day look like then? Outside of things like the Dunhill, I mean, obviously, that's not every day of the week, is it?
No, of course. Most of the time, it's an early start at where we are, 6 a.m. hour. We're starting the office at 6. We're organising the early morning golfers, making sure the caddies are going where we've kind of where we've got them scheduled to go to, and we're also trying to make sure we marry up the caddies with the golfers. And also, we've got a large list of single golfers that come down in the morning, so obviously we've got to try and take care of them as well. So that's our early morning start. Then from kind of 9 till 3, there's one of us in the office, and there's one guy on the first tee, again, just doing the same thing, just making sure that caddies are going where we're hoping they're going to go, golfers are taken care of, and that's kind of my day. And then at the end, again, we're just trying to organise the next day. We've got on a good day now in St Andrews, we've got almost 300 guys going out, so it's a lot of administration between the night before and that day. It's a very busy place. I'm based in the office now. My impairments mean I couldn't caddy anymore.
Right. And so when did you stop that?
2007 was my last caddy season.
Right. And you have quite an in-depth caddy program there that you put. You can't just turn up there and carry somebody's bag. I know you've got quite a good training program there, and it's pretty thorough, isn't it?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. We try to. We don't take a lot each year. We have a small team that we take on as trainees, and there'll maybe only be anywhere between 4 to 8 of them. And we try and, we'll try and put them with caddies that have got a lot of previous experience, and just try and get the caddies to just learn. I mean, unfortunately, most of the learning you do is on the job, and everybody's going to make, as a trainee, you're going to make mistakes, but I think the customers appreciate that anybody's first couple of months doing that is going to be tough going. So most of them are very good with it.
And tell me, you've been an accomplished golfer, and you played to a pretty low handicap, 3, I think, for most of your adolescence. So did you ever have any aspirations to become a tour professional when you were a youngster?
I think when I was very young, I think I did. But I think from probably the age of 14, 15, I realised I just never quite hit the ball far enough, and I wasn't just quite good enough. I was lucky enough to be quite good friends with a few guys that actually did play on tour, so I knew I was quite a ways behind them, and that was quite a, you know, I knew then I wasn't never going to be good enough to make it at that level, and I was more intent on being a good caddy at that stage.
But I mean, you had some successes. You won several events, and I know you won the men's club championship at your home course. You've been in the sport for, well, probably from 10 years of age forward when you were introduced to the sport by your grandfather. Was he a keen golfer?
Yeah, he was. He was very keen. He wasn't the best player. I mean, he wasn't the most fantastic player. I think he might have been, you know, high single figures, maybe 10 handicap, but he was a heavy, he used to enjoy practicing, and I really liked that, because when I used to go down and see them every night, we'd be out at the park hitting balls, and I used to love that kind of stuff. So that was where I kind of got my early thing of loving to practice, and I still, to this day, I love practicing. So that was, he installed that into me. So you know, I love hitting balls. I actually sometimes enjoy practicing more than I enjoy playing.
Did you play any other sports as a youngster?
I didn't play like quick ball sports. I think even as a kid, I realised that with my condition, I was never really going to be a fantastic footballer. So I played snooker, and I was quite, you know, I'm quite an accomplished snooker player, but not professional standard. But I do play, and I still do play actually.
And tell me about you inherited a disorder called hereditary spastic paraplegia. Now, in my research, that I found that this is a gene abnormality which causes the long nerves of the spine to deteriorate. Can you talk me through how this condition affects you in day-to-day life?
Yeah, I think for me, personally myself, it's painful. So every single step I take every day hurts. From the minute I wake up to the minute I go to my bed, every time I put my foot on the ground, it hurts. So the hard bit is trying to manage it, because medicine works, but there's a fine level of taking enough for it actually to make, you know, if I took enough medicine for it to work, I wouldn't be able to function. So there's a fine line between balance and taking in the right medicine and taking enough of it.
Yeah. And how do you manage that? Do you feel different sensations if you're taking a little bit too much or not quite enough?
Yeah,
obviously, if you don't take enough, you feel more pain. But
yes, of course.
But
yeah,
if you take too much, how does that react with you?
Yeah, that's over about 10 years now. I've learned the right amount for me, because we're going to work in the morning. I know that if I take too much, I can't function. So I kind of try and manage it, where if I know I'm going to my work, I take a certain level. And if I know that I'm going to be off and not going to work, I take a little bit more. So it's just been through, I've just learned through time the correct amount for me, through kind of trial and error.
Yeah, and it seems that this HSP is a progressive condition that I guess can be anything from mild initially with stiffness and spasticity of the legs, but which can progress to making walking difficult without any kind of assistance, I suppose. And in some cases, there are other symptoms, including impaired vision, lack of muscle coordination, epilepsy, deafness. Have you noticed any progression of your HSP? And if so, how have you had to adapt?
Yeah, I only got diagnosed with it about 6 years ago. We thought for 20 years we've been going to doctors and really not had any idea, and we got lucky. It was a university had been doing some research, and they sent my blood away, and they got lucky enough to find it, because at the time they thought it was something more serious. They considered I had MS or cerebral palsy, one of those things. So I was actually, it sounds bad, but I was glad that was what was wrong.
Right.
But over the last kind of 6 or 7 years, I've noticed my condition getting gradually just worse and worse and worse, where I can't do things now I could do 5 years ago. And you'd even notice it with just even simple things like going up the stairs in the house.
Right.
I just don't get up as well as I did 3 or 4 years ago.
Yeah.
And I've had to adapt to like walking, you know, I now use a walking stick, and when I'm playing golf, probably I use a buggy more than what I ever did. The only thing now is luckily St Andrews is as flat as a pancake.
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm having a good day, I can actually sometimes play without the use of a buggy.
Right. Going forward, how are you, I assume that you're doing things to try and delay any kind of further progression. What kind of medicines or prescriptions or exercise or any kind of things that you're doing that you can tell us about that you're trying to use to delay this progression?
Yep, mostly I would say probably for me it's kind of I'm trying to keep fit. I try and do any like exercises that involve stretching. I've tried Pilates. I've tried a bit of yoga, which is maybe a bit extreme for me, but Pilates is a good way for me, just to, anything that I can lengthen the muscles is going to help.
Right.
I found medicine, I'm kind of, medicine-wise, I'm taking as good as what I'm going to get for my condition. So it's really just any exercise that I can lengthen the muscles is good for me. And I've tried, say, Pilates, I still go, I go when I can. I can't go all the time, again, because if I have a, if I'm having a bad day, there's no way I can go. But
and you recently went to an inclusive golf session delivered by Edgar's development manager, Mark Taylor. What was your experience of that training session?
I was very impressed in the work done, well, that is getting done by the coaches and the volunteers on behalf of the Alfred Dunhill Links Foundation. I think there's a great opportunity to get a lot of people involved in golf that may not even have thought about golf. Mm-hmm. I think golf, it could be a great way of getting people socialising, meeting new people, and probably could enhance their lives a lot.
Do you see many players at St Andrews that have disability playing the course?
I think we see it a lot, because I think we see a lot of people that would be obvious. You know, you see people in buggies and you see people, but I think the people that we don't see, the people that would be less obvious.
Yes.
You know, everybody sees somebody in a buggy and then it's obvious that there's something wrong, but I think you don't see that. Obviously, there's a lot of people with a lot of things that we know nothing about.
Yeah.
And I think if we could reach out to more people in that way, we might have a great chance.
I guess that's the challenge, isn't it? Because it's kind of almost like, not that the person hides their disability, it's just that it's not seen, it's not visible.
Of course.
And that seems to me to be one of the biggest challenges, is that there's people out there that are playing the game, and we know they're playing the game, and they're fully integrated into the sport, playing at their local golf club, and people go, oh, yeah, but everybody's fine. Well, not everybody is fine. Some people are dealing with disability on a daily basis. And so I guess that's where we really need to make some big inroads.
One of the questions I actually did ask, and I don't, when we were at the, and I thought it was a very good one, when we were at the course with Mark, was about, I don't know about England golf, but I know in Scotland golf, I don't think that we, as Scottish golf, I don't think we ask about how many people are actually participating as disabled golfers in Scotland and how many we've got in golf clubs.
I just don't
think that we really know how many people we actually have.
I think you're right, and I'm sure that there's a lot of people that are playing in golf clubs that do have a disability. I think there's a percentage of those that don't consider themselves disabled, even though perhaps they, you know, they have a disability. The government say they've got a disability, but they don't consider themselves to be disabled. So I think there's a number of that style of person that's out there. But I do think there's a lot of the golf clubs that absolutely do not know how many people are already playing. And for sure, the federations and the golf clubs have no concept on the quantity of people that have got disability in the general population that could be new golfers in the future.
Of course,
World Health Organization tells us that somewhere in the region of 15% of the world is disabled. So that's a pretty sizable number of people
when
you consider 7 billion people around the world. And so a few thousand people with disability, not only is the right thing for the player to be able to participate in a sport that perhaps they couldn't, but it's also good for the game as well, because you've got more people playing the game, more people involved in green fees and club memberships and playing in competitions and, you know, just playing social golf and using more golf balls and buying more golf equipment. So it's good for the sport, it's good for the industry, as well as good for the person.
Yeah. I would say golf courses, in a way, are more and more accessible to disabled participants than ever before. There's more buggies, but I think golf clubs still could be made more accessible to people.
Agreed.
I just don't think they think about disability when at any stage.
Totally agree with you. And I think the new architects, I think they're beginning to think about it. They're beginning to think about, well, you know, do we have, and it's not only for disabled players, I think it's also for, it's ridiculous to think that a golf course for a man and a woman will have exactly the same experience by just putting the tee a little bit further forward.
Yeah,
so I think they're now beginning to understand that actually they need to almost design, and I say this in inverted commas, almost design two or three different golf courses in the same golf course.
Yeah.
So one would have maybe a slightly shorter tee and one would be perhaps a little bit more disabled friendly and so on and so forth. Are there any specific shots as a result of your disability that are particularly difficult?
Yeah. I'm a very poor driver of the golf ball. Driving is my Achilles heel. My condition kind of, I walk very poorly, so that's kind of deteriorated my hips and my knees quite badly.
Okay.
So I really struggle with to rotate through the ball.
Right.
So my driving is horrific. So that's my biggest challenge. I really struggle, and uneven lies as well, because I can't use my body. I really, the minute the ball's like above my feet, below my feet, I really have a struggle with that.
I must say, it made me smile when you said that St Andrews is flat as a pancake. I seem to remember every time I've played a shot there, I seem to be playing off the ball below my feet or above my feet.
Yeah. When I mean flat, I think I mean more like actually, you know, I mean, I wouldn't mean flat as a pancake. I mean flat in terms of there's no big hills.
Exactly.
There's no big hills to go up, but I know what you mean. It's very undulating.
It sure is. It's a real challenge. Although my father, who's a golf professional, has always said to me, he said that people that learn to play golf on an undulating golf course or a hilly golf course learn to play the game better than somebody who learns to play on a flat golf course. And I have some sympathy with that. I think he's probably bang on the button with that one. What have you learned about yourself by playing golf, Paul?
I've probably learned I'm very stubborn. I think I don't give in very easily to anything that's kind of put in my way. I've learned to, I try not to see myself as I've got anything wrong with. So when I play golf, I play golf. And I don't want anyone to feel sorry for me because there's something wrong with me.
Yeah.
I want to be treated the same as what, when I go out and play golf, I want to be the same as, if we're playing with four of us, I want to be treated the same as everyone else is. I don't want anyone to feel sorry for me. I just want to be treated the same.
That certainly comes across with all the people that I've spoken to, that, you know, that's the beauty about our sport, is that, you know, the modifications for the rules are so small. They're very important, by the way, the modifications. Mm-hmm. They're so small, these modifications, that literally you're basically playing this exactly the same game, and everybody wants to be treated just as a golfer first. And I guess that's where the strap line of Edgar came from a few years ago. And we just kept saying, the golfers first. These guys are golfers first. And it's nice to hear that. And of all the things that you've learned about playing golf, you've got such an experience caddying for lots of players, some good players, I'm sure, some not so good players, I'm also sure. Are there two or three takeaways that you think others might be able to learn from?
Yeah, something I've learned only a little while ago, except that golf isn't fair. We're all going to hit poor shots. And you know what? Yeah, I think except, because I used to be very hard on myself for a long time, hit a bad shot and I would be grumpy and the guys would be going, look, what's wrong, Paul? You know, you've got to accept that golf just isn't, except that it's not a fair sport. You're going to get bad bounces, you're going to get good bounces, but whatever it does, just accept it.
What are the most common mistakes that you see people standing on that first tee at the old course at St Andrews?
Everybody. If I've probably done something like, let's say in 20 years, I've probably done something like 5,000, 6,000 caddy rounds. Everybody thinks they hit the ball much further than they do. They go 7 iron 160. You might have hit it once 160 on a very downhill par 3, but you're not hitting it 160 every time.
Yeah.
Everybody underclubs.
Yeah. Yeah, you can put me in that boat as well. I do that occasionally. Any adjustments that you would make to the game to make the game just to make golf more user friendly for golfers with disability?
Again, I think it comes as a sport. I don't know what we could do to make it any more different, because again, I like to think that golf, I like to think I'm playing the same sport that everyone else is playing. I think again, if we go back to golf clubs and stuff, I think golf clubs and golf courses, getting back to the accessibility thing, I think that's for me where I like to see it go, rather than the actual sport.
Yeah.
If you understand what I'm meaning.
Yeah, I understand completely. Is there anything that you'd like to discuss that until now we've not touched upon? I've got a few general questions for you in a second, but anything that you'd like to discuss until now we haven't spoken about?
Well, we're going back to the one with Mark at the conference thing in Edinburgh.
Mm-hmm.
I think we've got a huge opportunity, whether it be in Scotland, Fife, England, wherever. I think here, especially in Scotland, we've got a few guys doing a bit of promotion with disability sport, but I think, you know, I think we could do something really good and get a lot more people involved. And whether they ever would even get to a golf club, just even giving them an opportunity just at a local practice centre to try and play would be huge for them.
I agree, totally. Well, we're working hard to try and bring that about. Not easy, because we've got some politics that we have to go through, but certainly we've got some people that are trying to make this happen, and some of the development work that we're doing now, I think hopefully within the next few years will really start to pay dividends. Anything about Paul Ellison that might surprise us?
I mean, I suppose caddying for Samuel L. Jackson for probably 5 Dunhills would be the only surprise. In fact, there's not much that people wouldn't know about me.
What's he like? Is he a good man?
Oh, he's fantastic. He's one of the most down to earth people you could ever meet, because you think that he's the highest grossing actor ever, because he's been in so many films. He's generated the most amount of money that any films have ever made.
I'm sure.
But you would never ever believe. And he was, if you talk about a mad keen golfer, he was the, you know, he would play, he had it in his contract when he was a, he had it in his contract when he was an actor that he had to get X amount of days off to play golf.
Really?
To be able to play at the best golf courses.
Really?
So they had to sort that out for him before he would take the role.
Right. Well, I remember in one of the films that he did, that I think it was, now I'm trying to remember the name of the film now, The 53rd State, I think it was.
Yes.
He had a golf club in his hands.
Yeah, that was the one set in Liverpool, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly,
yeah. Yeah, that was a good film.
What piece of golf equipment gives you the most joy, Paul?
Driver and putter. It gives me a lot of satisfaction when I hit a good one, because I'm so used to hitting poor ones. So I get quite pleased with myself when I actually hit. And I think because my golf has, my handicap actually hasn't deteriorated that much over the years, but I've had to develop my game. I've had to turn into having a very, very good short game where I never used to. So, I mean, like, as we sit today, I'm playing off 4. So my kind of my handicap hasn't really deteriorated that much. It's just the style of golf I play has changed a lot.
Anybody,
and I'm a very, very good par.
Anybody who plays off 4 handicap's a good player. Now, you've seen a lot of players. You've been up close and personal with many. But I'm going to give you a choice now. You can have 3 players to partner you. I assume it would be around on the old course. They can be dead or alive. And who would your 3 playing companions be, and why?
Why? Well, I think they would all be golfers. And I think I would love to see 3 different people from 3 different eras of golf. So I would go Bobby Jones, Arnold Palmer, and Tiger Woods. Same equipment, and see how everybody stacks up against each other. So you'd see Bobby Jones, Arnold Palmer, and Tiger all with the same equipment, and see what happens.
Bobby Jones, if I'm not mistaken, seemed to have a bit of a love-hate relationship with the old course at the beginning. Is that true?
That's true, yeah, because on the, I think we've got a bunker named after him because he kind of ripped his scorecard up in disgust on one of the bunkers on the 11th. So that was his kind of, so we've got Bobby Jones' bunker. So he's got, when he first came, he didn't have much of a great relationship with it, but then afterwards he won a lot of things there.
I'd love to come back to you at some point in the future, in the near future, and have a chat with you about the old course and about caddying. If you permit me to do that, I would love to do that at some point, not very far down the road. But to keep context of this interview, if you could magically be with someone who has a similar disability to yourself, what advice would you want to offer them?
I would just say enjoy every day. Some days are going to be better than others. Just have a good perspective, have a good perspective on life, because if you don't, it'll get you, I think things will get you down pretty quickly.
Good advice. If people wanted to reach you, Paul, how could they find you?
I'm on Facebook.
What is your handle there on Facebook? What's your address?
I am Switch Off.
Switch Off?
Yeah, that was my nickname as a caddy. I'll not go down any. We won't go down that road. But
that's another conversation I'm going to have with you over
here. Conversation. To be honest, I'll have to double check that.
Okay, maybe you can send that to me and then I'll correct that.
I'll send
in the show notes.
Twitter as well.
Twitter as well.
I'll take Twitter as well. I'll email you both of those.
Lovely.
Tony.
Well, lovely. I'll certainly get. I'll be following you to find out what you're doing next. Paul, it's been fascinating chatting with you. I've really enjoyed it, and thank you very much for making the time. I know you're very busy, and hopefully I'll get to see you very soon in one of the Edgar events somewhere, or maybe one of the events up in Scotland.
Yeah, I will do. Well, if you're in St Andrews, just give me a message, and I can maybe help you with a game if you're up in the St Andrews area.
Fantastic. Paul, look forward to that day, and we'll have a beer, as I say. I need to find out a little bit more about that old course.
Right, brilliant.
Thanks for your time.
All right, thank you. Cheers.
Okay, hey, bye. Bye.
Thanks. Bye.
This was an Edgar Player story supported by Ping, helping golfers to play their best. For more information about Edgar, please visit edgargolf.com. Stay tuned for the next Edgar podcast. Ping. Play your best.